Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 97, Loving Kindness for Your Enemies.
The comment was that one of the things that drew her to this retreat was that in the title was included the idea of inner enemy, and especially fear, and realizing how many of us hold this kind of fear or common fears about, for example, not being good enough, and then that kind of fear can prevent us from feeling alive. Mm-hmm. 1985, I was doing intensive loving kindness practice. And in the course of that kind of practice in a structured, systematic way, you move from offering loving kindness to yourself through offering loving kindness to all these different categories of beings, a benefactor, help to, friend, neutral person, somebody you don't particularly like or dislike, and then the person known as the enemy. And it is really fascinating. I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about that kind of unfolding of the development of love and compassion. But I can remember my my meditation teacher, Burma Saito Upandita, when he was giving me the instruction for offering loving kindness to an enemy. And of course, it's very complex because it needs to be infused with a great deal of wisdom. You know, not a kind of stupid thing and a weak thing and a foolish thing, but it can seem so much like that. And so it takes tremendous discernment, understanding, and wisdom to really get what, say, compassion is, what it's not. But anyway, so he was introducing that phase of the practice. Then he looked at me and he said, well, of course, if you don't have an enemy, you don't have to go out and make and I thought, I don't have any enemies, you know. And then I went back to my room and I started meditating. I was like, oh, yeah. There are a few, aren't there? You know, like, look at that. It was a very big surprise to me, you know, that there were just these corners of, you know, holding a grudge or feeling alienated from or having a big sense of the other, you know, or separation. It was quite interesting to see. And then, of course, even before that, one, in offering loving kindness, say, to a good friend, it's a very common experience. I've seen it many times, not only in my own practice, but in others. You know, it's very common to think of a benefactor or a friend, somebody you hold dear and you cherish, and you feel all grateful for them, and you're offering them loving kindness, and then you're feeling so filled with love, and then suddenly there's this memory, like, oh, there was that one time, you know, that I called, and you weren't really there for me, and maybe you're not my benefactor, you're my difficult person. I think often of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who said, I don't know, maybe he's quoting Shanti Devi when he's talking about friends becoming enemies and enemies becoming friends.
Absolutely.
It's a mutable system. Quite amazing topic, really.
Right. Well, that's very key when you're visualizing your enemy and your friend, or the one who, when you think of them, they make you feel good, and when you think of them, they make you feel really creeped out. And then realizing that because of your fear toward the one and because of your memory of something pleasant, your desire toward the other. And so really your emotions are painting them as likable and not likable. And then you can find that. I was going to ask everybody to think of their enemy. Who's your big enemy? I was thinking of mine. thinking of a guy with a black hood and a big sword who was about to bed. Somewhere, some Al-Qaeda type. Or who would do, but you must have some closer to home. You have a Frankenstein mural? Who owns the company now is going to kick out some students, some workers. Incredible. So everyone should think about their, who is their enemy? Right? Is anybody here like Sharon was? Well, I don't really have any enemies. Anybody like that? Yeah, you don't have any? Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, if they come and kidnap you and then they put you on television and threaten to behead you. Or you know, there was this wonderful article. Where did I read this? That we taxpayers have been supporting the most highly staffed and expensive madrasa to produce terrorist fanatics against the United States. We have been actually supporting it with our tax dollars, and it's called Guantanamo. And it is a school for producing hatred for us. And most of the people there were just some taxi drivers. And now they really hate us. And whenever they eventually get out, they really will try to get revenge. And they were also taught, because the Al-Qaeda people stayed in amongst them and then, you know, cell to cell, you know, gave them the wrong interpretation of the Quran and the whole thing. So they're really indoctrinated now. Everybody, all the graduates who get out, when they are released, they're going to like, I don't know, they're going to go after Dick. Well, I hope they go after Dick Cheney first. That's all I can say. But they'll go after any of us, of course, because they see us as just the same. But it is apparently established from people who've worked there and even some people who have graduated. And what actually goes on at Gitmo with them clanking around those orange seats with the chains and everything is they're being indoctrinated into a hatred army, really. They're going to be the leadership. Apparently Massoud, the guy in the Swat Valley who broke the truce with the Pakistani government and then brought down the Pakistan army on the head of them, was a graduate of Guantanamo.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then he became a leader amongst the Taliban in that part of Pakistan. And then just wouldn't like compromise with anybody, cutting everybody's head off. It's amazing that it goes on. It's incredible. But then we ourselves, they're my enemy. I feel an enemy, enmity toward terrorist person. I do. I feel genuine enmity toward them. And I see some of our own politicians as enemies. And I guess some sort of competitors and rivals in my university and, you know, somebody who makes really a hassle, creates unnecessary hassles in the department. And what else? There's a lot of people who make you upset if you think about it, I think, right? Don't you feel that? Threatening, they've hurt you. Right, what is it in the Dhammapada Buddha says? He hurt me, he deceived me, he robbed me, he beat me. By thinking such thoughts, hatred will never cease. Right? Hatred will never put an end to hatred. But first we have to find that hatred. We have to admit to ourselves that we very much do have enemies. We think of being killed, someone killing us. That's really the big thing, isn't it? What is the worst they could do to us? Well, it could kill our loved ones, I guess, would be, is actually worse than killing us. Killing our loved ones. And imagine when we bomb a civilian village in Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever, the survivors of a house that gets flattened by a bomb, how they must hate us. You know, they've killed their children or their parents or their spouses, brothers and sisters. It's incredible that we keep, our leaders keep doing this. It's just so incredible. And when we don't think about it, don't we feel kind of a little secret feeling of ease when we hear that they did kill a few Taliban. They killed a couple of Al-Qaeda. They tried. Imagine if they actually found Osama bin Laden nailed to his like dialysis machine with his like microphone. It would really be. But it wouldn't make any difference, really. Excuse me? Did someone speak? So shall we meditate on that for a second? Let's think about who really makes you feel uncomfortable. Who is the outer enemy? Then lately I've been reading about just to help you with some examples, I've been reading about the meat and dairy industries and the people who are killing all the 60 billion cows in the United States, releasing more methane than all the power plants and all the automobiles release carbon dioxide. Biggest planetary environmental danger are the billions and tens of billions of cows and the cattle in the world, in the beefed up world. And they are persisting in it. The swine flu came from Smithfield meatpacking, like pig shit pools in Veracruz. There's three of them, I think. They have three plants with no environmental controls, no attempt to mix the effluent anywhere. Just dump it in some sickly pond. People who do that, and they play golf, and they make money doing that. The crazies overseas want to kill us all. Telling the North Korean guy, our boss, cool. Then I think the biggest one is to meditate on the. I think it takes us right to death, doesn't it? Don't you get, if you really get into it, I do, at least I come straight on to death. And someone killing me or my loved one, my grandchildren, that's like the living end. In Judaism, they have, God demands that Abraham sacrifice Isaac, kill him himself to God. Which is always arouses a lot of controversy. People, if you really deeply think about it. In Buddhism, they have a story of the Buddha and his life just before he became a Buddha. Just previous to being a Buddha, he was a prince who had a vow to give everything to everybody. And in the climax of his story, a sort of evil, old wizard kind of demands him the gift of his two children to be his servant. But the children are frightened and they scream that he's really a goblin, he's going to be a cannibal, he's going to eat them. But the Buddha steals himself and he gives them anyway. Although, you know, in Buddhist stories, so they are later returned. Well, just as in the Jewish story, then God relents and says, leave Isaac alone, and puts a poor lamb in his place. These are deep teachings about this deep level about death. And our own death is also quite something. So think about why are you worried about dying yourself? Let's think about it. Why am I worried about it? Why would I be so upset? I would kidnap and beheaded on television, on videotape. No more toothache. What would happen? Tortured. How would we hate someone tortured? think of. How on earth are we supposed to deal with fear and hate, anger? We will should be feeling really deeply confronting this. And on your worst fear being realized. And it's happening. Incredible. Doesn't it tell us that somehow we have that fear even when we don't meditate? Like completely part of our world, sort of out there. If there were an external source that the whole structure of our life is oriented around, that is, therefore, even though it's not happening to us, we're imprisoned by. By its potential. Don't you think? And so we accept all kinds of irrational measures and structures in the seeming, and we also delude ourselves and blind ourselves to aspects of reality. Because it seems to keep this away, isn't it? My Christian mystic friend David Spangler in the 70s at Findhorn in Scotland was channeled. He was a medium, and he was young, but he was a medium. He channeled someone called John. And some people think it was the John who wrote the book of Revelation. But he gave a different message than the one in Revelation seems to be to the fundamentalist, which I've always loved. Yeah, somehow it's coming in my mind, which is that the new age, you know, the new Jerusalem, the new time, the time when people can live without fear, is already here for those who choose to overcome that fear. And it's like it's if they're on the same earth as those who are living caught up in the fear and the violence. But it's like the when they look down, instead of seeing this dark sort of shell or crust that's upholding all these terrors, that it could be moving toward you, against which you defend. Like streaks of lightning cracking this dark shell, like from within. And this is a gentle lightning. It's a luminescent energy, which is the abundant universe, the abundant world, abundant earth. And it's just a matter of like stepping like an inch to the side, or one's vision turning just slightly. And then one suddenly feels borne up in that abundance. It's a marvelous image. In other words, the new age is here already. The battle Armageddon has already happened. It's been happening. Anyway, it's still going on, but there are those already beyond it. We can be beyond it if we choose. And then we have to achieve something to be able to follow through on that choice. And I guess fear of death is one thing that we have to overcome, so we have to confront death. But then that one that's, I can't, maybe Sharon, can you help? Fear of pain, I can't deal with myself. I'm so afraid of pain. You know, like torturing, it would even be worse than dying, I would think. One would beg to die. People do, don't they, when they're tortured? They beg to just put me out of my misery. We have that expression. But on the other hand, there is a, although people can be skillful to avoid a threshold, there's kind of a threshold where you dissociate from the pain, I think. So even the worst pain, can be confronted, maybe. I'm sorry, but that was a meditation. Okay, just chime in, you know. I think we don't have to go like back and forth. I'm trying a chiming in method.
Okay, we're gonna chime in.
You chime.
Did you have a?
You chime. I wish we had that movable mic. Yes. You know, I did a very stupid, first I have to confess one thing. I have a new hearing aid, and I put it in a shirt pocket, and then I changed my shirt, so I don't have it on me tonight.
But it's a very nice shirt.
I put another nice shirt on, but it was in
a, it is a very nice shirt. Good color.
So I apologize, but you either have to shout or Sharon will have to tell me what
you're
saying.
Yeah, I'll repeat it.
Because we don't have that mic. I'm sorry. Yes. 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 Physical and emotional. Oh, I love emotional pain. I'm so used to it. I'm so used to it. The physical pain is the one I should be used to that too at my age. But you know, like it, tooth pain or something. Why do we have teeth anyway? I always wondered. I think we have them to teach us something about sensitivity. The dentist drill and so on. Ooh. Root canal.
Well, I was thinking about fear of death. Because for a few reasons. One is a couple of weeks ago on Mark Epstein's recommendation, actually, those of you who might have been there at the Vet House, I fought with him. He was highly, highly praising the Broadway show, Exit the King. And
what's it called?
Exit the King.
Exit the King.
And he praised it so much that some of us, some friends and I who were sitting that day, and I decided to go see it. So we went to see it, and I thought it was amazing. It was just amazing, and it's all about the death of this king. who every once in a while, Susan Sarandon, who plays one of his queens, will say, you're going to die in 90 minutes because the play's going to be over. Or you're going to die in 60 minutes or, you know, after intermission. So it's all about his process of coming to terms with the fact that he's going to die.
Yeah.
And he's already, you know, in this mythological story, 300 years old. So it hasn't really been on his mind. You know, he fights it, frightened, and he resists it. And it's an extraordinary play. So you really see his process of trying to come to terms with this. So during intermission, you know, we all went out to the bathroom, and coming back, one of my friends was just laughing hysterically and said he'd overheard a conversation where this guy on his way out of the theater for intermission was saying, is this play supposed to be about anything? You know, and I thought, isn't that amazing? You know, he just watched, like, the same thing I watched. But it was a very different experience. And I thought, really, how we're taught in society to numb out, look the other way, and avoid what's unpleasant. You know, we're not necessarily given an awful lot of help all along the way in terms of awareness, balance, opening, and so on. So that was one of the things I thought of. And then I thought of a friend of ours named Rick Fields, who died years ago from cancer. And at one point he said, I'm not going to make an enemy of my own death.
Right.
Which was really quite amazing. I mean, this is part of our talent, you know?
I love one of your books where you said, I don't remember which one, where you said about how you appreciated Buddha making first noble truth be the suffering, because it sort of gave you the permission to actually really face it, confront it, and get started on reality. And otherwise, there was the thing about even when you're suffering, you're supposed to not be or something, or supposed to not be happening, and sort of doubles the pain. I really liked that. I don't remember which book it was, but it was great. It was, I didn't see anybody in an ancient classical source say it like that, the way you did. I thought it was really quite wonderful. But then, of course, when pushing on from that, though, then what about death? What do you think happens when you die? When you confront your death and think of yourself dying, what do you think is going to happen to you? How many people think it will simply fade into oblivion? How many people here think that? And said, oh, not too many. But a few serious ones. Don't look nervous here. I am going to strongly criticize that view, but that's okay. But then you shouldn't be much afraid of it. It's just a matter of how you do it, right? Because there's nothing to be afraid of if you just cease to exist. You know what I mean? That's not a big deal. Unless you're really having a great time. If you cease to exist at the time of having a really hot time, that might feel like an interruption. But in our usual slogging around semi-miserably, as we get older and older, then it gets more than semi. I think it's a relief, right? Like when you fall asleep at night. You're really sick and tired of the day, and you really don't want to hear another thing, and you don't want to see another thing, you don't want to hold another thing, you don't want to do another thing, and then you to blissfully slip off into unconsciousness. Right? So, you know, that sleep of death, what is it? Or in the chance to dream. Aye, there's the rub. Or in that sleep of death, when we have shuffled off this mortal coil, what dreams may come. Must give us pause, right? Something like that.
Something like that.
Any line that I can remember. Undiscovered country from whose born no traveler returns. Shakespeare said it all, you know, he was some kind of bodhisattva.
Yeah.
My mother thought Shakespeare was Buddha. She was convinced. She said, oh, you like Buddha, but I like Shakespeare. Well, that's I feel that's very important. In a way, it's nice to think of becoming nothing. It's a nice way to do something, to be. But it's better than worrying about hell, which religious people can worry about quite intensely when they come close to death. Or when someone thinks a lot about death, one thinks about more unpleasant states of existence than one's present state of existence. One fears that. And it's nicer to feel somehow confident that nothing is going to happen. That makes it one able to confront that. So in the moment, I won't get all go off on a tear on that. Not quite yet. But then in that case, then the enemy is just sort of putting one out of one's misery, maybe removing one from the access to a few pleasures more in life that life may have to offer momentarily here and there. But if it's a clean kill, it isn't too painful and drawn out, then one shouldn't be that afraid of death. And if one is not that afraid of death, then one can at least live without fear anticipating dying in a certain way. So that's good. It's better than fearing hell. Or some sort of, like, looking, as the Buddhists call it, looking at the abyss, not only hell, but the animal kingdom, or a worse human life, or a preta life, a life of this hungry ghost, what they call it. Although they're not really ghosts. That's much more frightening, of going into some terrible domain where one has no control, where all kinds of terrible things can happen. So then, in a way, one's enemy, by taking one's life and hurling one into this some sort of maelstrom of uncontrolled life experiences, is really doing one quite a bit of harm. If one views the afterlife like that. Then religious people, of course, they mask that by having God or Jesus or Allah or someone, Krishna, even Buddha, the Buddhists, there are Buddhists who have that kind of attitude. Amitabha Buddha of the Western Paradise, just say his name, Namo Amida Butsu, and Namo Amitofo in Chinese. And then you are taken clearly to a heavenly celestial realm, or call out to Jesus or God or Krishna. So the one adds that in. So then in between, there are those of us who are not that sure about being nothing, and who are not that sure that any intercessor can completely take care of us. And then we're in the little most anxious, anxiety-producing state, would you say? That's the most anxious situation. Then, though, how we will go is determined by the quality of our mind now, what it's like, it seems. If we have real confidence that we know every corner of our mind, we're mindful of all of our impulses, all of our fears, all of our rages, all of our, like, attachments, then we can sort of thread our way through whatever jungle paths we might encounter, and we feel we could remain alert and awake and mindful and guide ourselves in a good direction, like a traveler who's well prepared for the journey. We sort of get into that sort of state of mind. That's the one that the Buddhist evolutionary teaching seeks to provide us with the tools to achieve. That's what I think I'm doing. That's what I'm trying to provide myself. Is that right, Sharon? When mindfulness, although you're counting your breath, and the more you notice of what comes up in your mind, as you're mindful of the body, of the mind, of the sensations of the mind and of the phenomena in the mind, right? The mm-hmm. dharma. You're actually becoming aware of your unconscious mm-hmm. impulses mm-hmm. and drives eventually, right? Which mm-hmm. is, can you tell, then people get freaked out when they do mindfulness? Is that why? Can you tell us about that?
I've had people freaking out.
Yeah, I know you have. I always remember the one story about the guy who went to IMS, and then about 4 or 5 days, he was running down the road screaming, "It didn't work! It didn't work!"
Oh, there's so many stories. Our poor neighbors.
What?
Our poor neighbors. Well, I always say mindfulness is like a relational quality. In the way we tend to use the word in contemporary usage, it's really mindfulness and clear comprehension. You know, it's like compound. So I describe it as a relational quality. So it's not just knowing what's going on, knowing having a certain emotion, certain thought, but it's relating to that thought or that emotion kind of balance. It's really made up of interest, because the idea is that mindfulness, as well as being a healed relationship with what's going on, is the platform for insight. So if something comes up, like fear, like in state, and we're struggling horribly against it, hate it, we hate ourselves for it, there's not going to be a lot of learning. And at the other extreme, if that fear comes up and we are overcome by it and just lost and defined by it, then clearly there will be a lot of to like diffusing. And so mindfulness is talked about as being a place in the middle where we don't get like lost and overcome by this stuff that comes up. We also don't reject, push away, hate it. And because it's said to be a relational quality, it's all about that balance. Perspective, everything. And of course, sometimes we lose it. We lose it with lots of different things. But the amazing, for me, one of the amazing aspects always was this idea that if we lose it, we can, you know, it's not irrevocable. It's not like, okay, failed, you know, meditation failed. That. We start over, or we regroup, or we rebalance that then same old way or different way. So over time, it becomes more steady state. So, yeah, all this stuff will come up always. And we have an opportunity with that not to call any of those states an enemy, nor to just do the same old sort of habituated getting lost in them. But to establish me.
You know, the interesting thing came up at the translators conference in India that I was at in March, where I was saying, and I think it is correct, in the Mahayana Abhidharma, mindfulness is classified as a foundational form of wisdom. But then someone was telling me that in the Pali tradition, it is actually categorized with samadhi. It's categorized with meditation. And I think that's very fascinating, that it has those two, that there is that difference. And so, you know, in the Eightfold Path, realistic worldview is the first, right? And then motivation, livelihood, speech, action. That's five, right? Which are all settling one down. And then there's what people call effort, but it means only effort in the good, so I don't think we have a word for that. You know, evolutionary creativity, what I like to call it. Someone then decides they're really going to better themselves. Oh, I loved in the latest Star Trek movie when, was it the latest? No, it wasn't the latest, it was an older Star Trek movie. Picard was appealing to his own clone who was going to destroy the universe with an antimatter gun. And he was appealing to him that that clone was not just a machine, he was human, because he was Picard's clone. And he, but that means clone of a human being. And that he had to, the essential human quality was that a human could always have a free choice and could always better themselves. I thought, I was being taught the Dharma by Star Trek years ago. That it was, in that moment, he didn't have to just react and because he was mad and it was, his plan was foiling, being foiled, then he was just going to, in a tantrum, he's going to destroy the universe. No, he could better himself, and he could not do it. But of course, the guy didn't make the choice, and then they had a blast, Data blasted. But I thought it was a wonderful idea that the human thing is to better yourself. So that virya there is evolutionary creativity. You can evolve yourself. And then mindfulness and meditation are the two. But the realistic worldview where the wisdom is, which is the first branch, is of course not dropped because you finished that branch. Now we don't need that one anymore. Those are all still with you, and then you. Could, that's why. Then so there is wisdom. I debated this guy. Saying, no, we say it's meditation. It's not wisdom. And I said no, but it draws the wisdom from the first branch of the path, right? You all know the Eightfold Path. How to get to Nirvana. No? Well, this is Nirvana. We're in Nirvana, okay? There's nothing to fear. There's no death. There's no pain. And there's no nothingness. That's very important. There is no such thing, luckily. And, or unluckily, it would be easy if there was just nothing. Yeah.
But it's sort of like, just to go to that point about mindfulness, and it's true, I think, in the Eightfold Path, Theravada. It's considered part of the meditation.
It's classified there, both there with samadhi.
But in other lists, like the seven factors of enlightenment.
Oh, good.
Or the five faculties.
Oh, good.
You know, it's said to be the source of investigation.
Right. Of course. So it's the foundation of wisdom.
So
absolutely.
Then it's the foundation of
guardian,
wisdom.
Guardian, the door. Actually, in the Chakrasambhara Mandala, the four mindfulnesses are the four... Uh-huh. Animal-headed Dakinis who guard the Dakini Lama, Kandarohi, and Rupini, who guard the four gates. And they have, one has a crow face, one has an owl face. They're very amazing.
That'd be fun.
Huh?
That'd be fun.
The eastern one has a crow face. Uh-huh. Has the face of a crow. You know, a beak, which is otherwise a beautiful female, but has a beak of a crow. Or like a bird. But anyway, that's aside. The point is that if we knew that reality was nirvana, our own reality right here and now, like right there, you know, right there with your, in between your glasses there on the bridge of your nose, that's nirvana right there, not somewhere else. And that therefore... our task is to try to use our consciousness to discover that reality. Then the whole Eightfold Path ensues to lead us to that. And of course, the gateway of the Eightfold Path is the wisdom and the realistic worldview. And the realistic worldview is that it isn't just believing that it's nirvana, because that's not impossible for us to believe, but it's believing that in causality, actually. It's believing that there's no escape from causality. It's just a very strange thing. Not something you think of as religious. It means you believe that you're connected. And realistic worldview is acknowledging your connection to things and therefore the causal process in which you are completely inwoven. And therefore, out of that arises a commitment. Maybe Sankalpa should be not motivation, but commitment. You know, samkalpa, growing out of samasamditti, samasamkalpa is a commitment. But once you realize that that's reality, then you're committed to, of course, enjoying that. It's just totally normal. It isn't even something fantastic. If it seemed to you that you're totally connected, that you're in an infinite web of causality, that you're completely part of that, that therefore that causality opens up infinite possibility, with danger of negativity as well, but therefore infinite positive possibility. And the infinite positive, of course, is nirvana, is blissful existence, eternal blissful existence. And so then you get a commitment to try to verify that. And then out of that commitment to verify that, you then decide to have a, you know, proper action. Only act in some sort of a really ethical and calming and terminal way, not in some way of stirring up more trouble. To speak only in that way. And to your livelihood, you ethically, you can't do anything that's disturbing to others or yourself, because that disturbs yourself because you're interwoven with them. And then you, once you've cleared those three things, which are like ethical things, you then decide that you then have the space to have this evolutionary creativity. And then the evolutionary creativity, the first thing you do with it is you sit at Sharon's feet and you practice mindfulness. And then when you get good at that, that turns into samadhi.
Yeah.
Where you really have control of your mind. So you then are in, doesn't mean you get out of the universe by samadhi. It means that you have complete ability to concentrate your mind. So your mind no longer drives you. It's yours to use to discover the nature of reality. Then you combine that one-pointed samadhi with the wisdom of reality, realistic wisdom, realistic worldview, and you achieve the awareness of your own self.
That's it.
That's the path. Okay, though some of you said you were new, so that's the path. Got it? You get it? It's completely different from some religious thing. It's a realization that what are you here? What is the purpose of your life? Why are you here? Besides the good vegan food here at Mela. No, I mean, why are you on Earth? I mean, what's the point? And then people say, oh, somebody put me here. They like blame God or some god or goddess. Or they blame their parents. Or they blame, I don't know, Richard Dawkins. Who is it? Darwin. They blame Darwin. And that's all ridiculous. Point is, you're here. You're free. You could shoot yourself anytime if you think you'd just be nothing and if it's too tiresome. But you are here, and why? What can you get out of it? What are you doing to others? And then some people will tell you that there's no reason that you're here. That's the orthodoxy in our science, which is not a religious teaching. It's supposedly a scientific teaching, but they have absolutely no evidence for either nothingness or that there's no that everything is random, accident. There's no evidence at all. Just a dog. And so they tell you that, and that you're just here, just spending the whiling away the time till you return to the nothingness, which is the base of reality. The empty void between the stars, the empty void inside the atom, a nice sleepy place. And so then you have no purpose, of course, if that's the case, and it's just eat, drink, and be merry, and whatever. But if that is wrong, and if actually there is this possibility that can make sense to you if you think about it, that you are a sensitive being that could achieve super bliss, supreme bliss, which you could then share with other beings, and that there are beings who have preceded you and have achieved that, called Buddhas. Which doesn't, again, not some religious title. It just means an awakened person who's really awake. You know, way past all of what we think of as awake, like where what we think of as awake is like asleep. So that kind of awake. And then, of course, it wouldn't be good to be awake. Actually, it would suck if everything was horrible. So then the sort of hopeful thing that we're still hoping, didn't know for sure still yet, but we're hoping. That awake, supposedly awake person said that once you're really awake, it's like a gas and a half. It's a super gas. And so we hope that's true. If not, it's going to be a cruel hoax. And like, what's the Buddha sitting there grinning about?
Yeah.
If it's not super, super groovy to be really awake. So then the enemy is then only that which impedes us in discovering that. It isn't death. It isn't even pain, which is my worst enemy. But or and therefore anybody who inflicts pain. Or and it isn't death. It's anything that blocks us from discovering the nirvana that is might be our reality, that has been suggested is our reality and the reality of everything. Okay?
Okay.
Is that right? Is that are we thinking this together? What do they say? Are we on the same page? So that's what we are working on, this retreat. Comment. Yes. I'm sorry.
The question was, is ego a good label that would prevent us from recognizing reality?
Sure. The ego is the Greek first person pronoun. As you know, probably, you know, Freud never used the Greek word, just used the ich word. Ich. The German first person pronoun, ich. And so the I really is called what we would say the I. The I is just a pronoun with which we can organize our subjectivity on our verbal consciousness. And but maybe, you know, there are two things. There's in the Tibetan tradition, there's ahamkara, which means I call it the I habit or the ego habit. And then there's the atmasneha, which means the ego cherishing or the self cherishing or the self preoccupation or the self narcissism, maybe. And to myself, I always think of the I habit as primary and the narcissism as secondary. But some of the lamas sometimes say it's the opposite. That the worst demon is the I cherishing. It's very strange. But then when they're coming at it from the compassion side, I still don't quite understand this relationship. But
is that because they suppose that if you have tremendous habit of selfishness, self-absorbed, self-preoccupation, competitiveness, jealousy, and all
yes.
whole list, then you're not going to be in a position that
maybe, or maybe it's in the context like the blade wheel of mind reform, where they're really pushing on, you know, compassion from the outset. So then the self, the narcissism, self-cherishing, the self-involvement is the block to being sensitive to what's happened to others. So therefore, you can have compassion. I think maybe that's why they emphasize it. But in a way, in a more technical way, it would definitely seem that, and that's where we will start tomorrow morning. It would seem that the ego, I don't like to call it egotism, I call it ego habit, because it is the perception of the self as an absolute, which we are wired to have, and which in a way animals also have, and which then justifies our sense of separation from others. It's because we reify some sort of essential being within ourselves that is some sort of an absolute thing. It's more real even than our body. And that's what I call the ego habit. Not the ego in itself, but that ego habit or that ego misperception, which is in our, it's the misprogramming in an ignorant or an unlike being's makeup, which then crystallizes their sense of separateness of self and others. Crystallize, you know, it absolutizes self, other, different, and puts one in the position of infinite suffering and infinite unsatisfactoriness of life. Because if you are the absolute different from everything else in the universe, and it is infinite and totally overpowers you, and you can never compete with it, and you can never dominate it, and you can never overcome it, and it will just, of course, destroy you again and again. And so you're definitely going to suffer. That would put us in analysis. And And even you, from the Buddhist psychological, scientific point of view, not religious, scientific point of view, the projection to a deity of an absolute self, could separate from everything else, but that yet is dominating everything else, is a completely unrealistic projection of the unrealistic sense of one, the absoluteness of oneself, and therefore is something that is truly psychologically sick. And imagining that there's the being like oneself, which someone does, knowing that oneself, although I feel I'm absolute, but yet all these relative things are crushing me, so I can take refuge in a being that I project as being there like I would like to be, uncrushable. That I'll just somehow jump over into that absolute and they'll take care of me. It's a sickness, actually. What? Sorry, yeah, I missed a couple of steps. What you want to do?
So the his comment was that what he meant by the word ego was sense of separation.
Yeah.
And so if somebody hurts you, but you have very strong conviction that they're really hurting themselves, because you're connected, then the that would take away the base.
Yeah, of course. But again, I'm just trying to be technical, because it was a very important point. Because in the Buddhist psychology, ego is just a pronoun. And actually, language is that which guides and controls our interaction with beings in the Buddhist view. In generally, Indian view in general, language is the most powerful thing, the way structure thing in the universe. So mantra, language, syllables. And so ego itself is just a word. But the habit of solidifying that and reifying that to some sort of absolute entity, like a fixed, you know, individual soul that is absolutely always you or something like that, even disconnecting from your body, that's the real problem. And so it's the exaggeration based on a misperception of, that's all I mean. I know what you mean by ego, and I agree with you. And of course that is, but the to do that is this is where then Buddhist psychology completely does not agree with modern, with the Freudian, post-Freudian psychology. Because although I think it does agree with some of the spiritual psychology of the mystical theistic people, who are not just making God into some absolute psychopath sitting outside the universe playing with it, but who realize that it's some kind of powerful energy everywhere, something like that, rather than a person like them, a totally connected powerful energy, good old pantheistic mystic heretic. Buddhist psychology says to achieve that, what you say, where when you someone hurts you, you see them more as hurting themselves. And they only can strengthen you because of your infinite flexibility, because of your awareness of reality, and your sense of being one with them. In order to do that, you have to completely clean up the Augean stable of your own unconscious, down all your instincts. You have to. The goal, the job, is going down through the 81 levels, the path of meditation. The Pali people call it, and the Mahayana people agree, it's the 81 levels on the meditation path of the five paths of the. All the different instinctual responses, the instinctual anchorings of this misperception of the self. Because it's not just a conceptual thing on the surface, although that helps to straighten that out. But then it has to be driven, it has to go way down into the gut. And that's a very, that's contradictory to what people think is possible. Because in Freud's theory, theoretically, the unconscious has to always be unconscious, but not in the Buddhist view. In other words, even the Buddhist view is that even the instinct to draw the next breath is a matter of choice. If you are enlightened, you're not driven to grasp at that oxygen and to gulp it down. You could simply not breathe it because you're not that attached to the inside as opposed to the outside, and to the body, the heart pumping as opposed to somebody else's heart. Whatever you mean, you really are not fixed in a particular skin. That It's very profound. It's this level that we're speaking, theoretically speaking. Well, this is a very wonderful question. And, you know, people will say, Buddhists will say, oh, soul, no, no, we don't have one of those. Oh, no, that's the wrong view. Oh, no soul. Which I'm very delighted that I critique that view very much. And the Dalai Lama is critiquing it nowadays and has given permission, which I'm pleased. Because why? Now, the concept of a immortal soul, as in, say, Catholic theology, as if there were something that is the individual's thing, it never changes, it's sort of absolute, that, you know, is not really connected to life, or even the concept of a soul that, say, the Sankhya or most of the Hindu philosophers have, that you're Purusha Atma, you know, your Parama Atma, your supreme self, is this individual thing that is sort of the absolute, that you just have to get away from being connected to everything and you'll be in this ultimate disconnected state. And that's what liberation is. That, of course, is what the Buddha says does not exist. But the subtle mental continuum, energy continuum of mind, it goes from life to life. That is what your subjectivity is. What constitutes your subjectivity in your dream state, where you have a virtual dream body, you know, where you see things because you have virtual eyes, you hear things, you have virtual ears, you have a virtual skin when you feel a touch. Rarely do we eat food in dreams. I guess if we're fasting or starving, we will. Then you have virtual taste buds and virtual, I don't know if you can smell something in a dream. Yeah, you could probably have a dream of a beautiful perfume or something. Think. Then you'd have a virtual nose. Sense organ. And so that subtle type of continuum that sort of carries on a pattern that has a sense of presence like you do when you're awake, when you're dreaming, even though your body is inert, your senses are shut down, that is what the soul is. And the soul, the soul is even more subtle than that, actually. It's what they call the extremely subtle level. But that's the jiva, the soul. And where the Buddha says no soul and no atma, no this, he's also saying no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no tooth, no nothing, no no yes, no no, no no, you know, like everything is no when you go no. Meaning that there is no such fixed, intrinsic, disconnected thing of any kind. Like your hand, there's no hand. And you can easily dissolve, your hand will dissolve under analysis if you do a thought experiment. You know, what's the boundary between hand and not hand? Is this finger the hand? Well, no, if I amputate this finger, I still have a hand. How many fingers do I have to take off before it's not a hand? Maybe if it's only the palms, it's just a hand. If the thumb is off, is it still the hand? At which chopping point does it cease being the hand? You know, in other words, you realize that their hand is something we arbitrarily think of as landing on something that exactly corresponds to just the hand, but it's not the case. You know, even atom, you go down to atom, electron. The scientists have caught up now with the Buddha's insight that anything in reality dissolves under analysis. And when he's therefore, when the Buddha's in his no, no, no mood, which he gets into, and he's not a two-year-old, he gets the no-nos, everything is no. But when he's in his relative reality mood, then there is a subtle energy continuum of a being, which they actually have a wonderful term for. They call it a mental gene or a spiritual gene. It's like the codes for your nostril shape and the earlobe and your jaw, cheekbones, and your chin are come in a coded instruction from your parent, chromosomes, and then they combine and then they build back up this body. You know what I mean? It's not like parent comes and puts a cookie cutter on you, some plasma, and makes you. It goes down to this really subtle molecular code and then builds back up cells, right? When you eat food and when you get nourished. And shapes proteins into you. And so the mind is also goes like that. It has a very subtle continuum, which is very okay to call the soul. And it makes sense, because otherwise you get that question, if there's no soul, how do you get reincarnated? How do you get reborn? And the fact that we live in an endless continuum and beginningless continuum, and we are ourselves endless and beginningless being, is essential to the Buddhist awakening project. It's totally essential. You cannot find the energy for diving into the depths of your own ferocious, lustful, sinful, weird, strange, unconscious, unless you feel that this is your great unique moment within an infinite evolutionary history to, in fact, make this quantum leap that the human being is capable, that the human being of your type, everybody in this room's type, is capable, which is to really get into the group. And the nirvana.
The question was, why does it have to be a quantum leap? Why is it not incremental?
Well, because we're like terrible, creepy, weird creatures. And we need quantum leap. We're going to improve ourselves. That's why. As far as dichotomy goes, non-duality contains dichotomy. Non-duality does not abnegate dichotomy. And our relative mind, our practical and relative mind, operates that way. And even when Buddha is talking to us, he speaks dualistically as well. And non-duality embraces the non-duality of monism and dualism. It isn't just monism. So dichotomy is useful, you know? Live or die, go in or out. Time is up or not up. We need dichotomy. Sleep or wake. Be tired or not tired.
And what's
Can I tell you a joke? I have a joke about a bear. Should I tell it? I don't think I shouldn't tell it.